Hello and welcome to Headlines. This is Aryeh Leibowitz. I'm filling in for David this week, and we have a very interesting show this week, although it is not the show that was advertised and that was scheduled. We had advertised that we were going to do a show on electric shavers and particularly lift and cut shavers. I believe David once did a show on electric shavers, but let me tell you what happened more recently. A new small book came out written by Rabbi Chaim Jachter together with his son Binyamin Jachter, cleverly titled Sefer HaSapar, and the Jachters, father and son, were able to make, to learn new information from the company itself, proprietary information about how lift and cut shavers work, and based on how they really work, not how they're advertised, not how people think they work, but based on how they really work, the Jachters wanted to argue that for those who are makel to use shavers in general, that a lift and cut shaver would be no different than any other shaver. And we wanted to do a show where I would interview Rabbi Jachter and then I would interview those who disagree or anyone who might disagree with this conclusion based on the metzius that he discovered. Rabbi Jachter was more than willing to have the interview. Unfortunately, we were unable to find anybody willing to discuss the issue of lift and cut shavers, except for those who hold against Rav Moshe entirely and hold like those gedolim that say that you're not allowed to use any electric shavers. But again, we didn't want to revisit that topic. That topic's already been done. It's an old machlokas. We know that there are many people that many great poskim that asur electric shavers entirely and do not hold like the Hagayin of Moshe Feinstein on that issue. So because we couldn't find two sides of the argument, we decided to go in a different direction. Many of you may be aware, I'm sure all of you are aware, that Ben and Jerry's, the Ben and Jerry's company, made news recently. And this is what we're going to discuss in this week's show. On July 19th, 2021, Ben and Jerry's issued a statement, the famous ice cream company with all the cleverly titled flavors, the Cherry Garcia and the Chunky Monkey and all of those funny flavors, a company that was started by two Jewish people who later issued a statement that they're supportive, even though they're no longer in control of the company, that they are supportive of this move. But the statement went that was issued by Ben & Jerry's on July 19th. We believe it is inconsistent with our values for Ben & Jerry's ice cream to be sold in the occupied Palestinian territory. They're referring, of course, to Yehuda and Shomron. We also hear and recognize the concerns shared with us by our fans and trusted partners. We have a long-standing partnership with our licensee who manufactures Ben & Jerry's ice cream in Israel and distributes it in the region. We've been working to change this, and so we have informed our licensee that we will not renew the license agreement when it expires at the end of the next year. And this caused quite a storm, certainly in the Jewish community, the pro-Israel community, that essentially they are boycotting sections of Israel. And many people had an immediate knee-jerk reaction that the Jewish people should not support Ben & Jerry's whatsoever. Obviously, if you're makbid not to have Chalav Stam, you're probably not having Ben & Jerry's anyway. But why is it that there's a kosher certification on Ben & Jerry's? Why do reliable hashgachos give hashgacha to Ben and Jerry's? And what I wanted to do is maybe discuss that issue. So we found that Rabbi Taub, Rabbi Moshe Taub, who's been on the show before, wrote an article about this topic and why he thinks that we should not immediately react in that way. That knee-jerk reaction, while understandable, is maybe not the proper approach to how to handle things like this. You know, sometimes people react emotionally and they don't think things through 100% fully. Get into hysterics instead of thinking through and really researching and going through the issue carefully. So in today's show, what we're going to do, we're just going to have one interview. Rabbi Taub wrote an article on it where he made several points, and I'm going to try to do my best to push back on a number of the points that he made. And we're going to see that this is the kind of topic that reasonable minds can disagree about. Now, let me be clear. I don't believe reasonable minds can disagree about whether Ben and Jerry's actions were warranted or not. No, they were absolutely terrible, and it's bad for the Jewish people. It's bad for the world that companies are are racing each other to be more one, to be more woke than the next, and to be more liberal than the next in terms of their Israel policies. You know, that is or anti-Israel policies. That is just absolutely terrible. But the question is what our reaction should be as a Jewish community, and we have a fascinating discussion with Rabbi Taub about that topic. But first, let's start with a Dvar Torah for this week. The Dvar Torah is going to be for Parsha Shoftim, since I imagine most people who listen to this will be listening to it after Shabbos is over. You know, when a person takes a bird's eye view of Chumash, instead of looking only at one word after the next, one pasuk after the next, if you look at in broad strokes at the topics that are covered, sometimes you'll find a section of the Chumash that discusses a theme, that discusses a series of topics that are related to each other. So you find that the theme that emerges at the end of Parsha Shoftim and into the beginning of the following parsha, Kisaita, is that it's a theme of war. You have a section on Mashuach Muhammad, the Kohen who rallies us before war. You have a section on Yifas Toar, how to handle a beautiful captive woman, and a section on Hashchasas Ilonos, how to deal with trees and land that we have conquered. Yet right in the middle of all that, the Torah tells us about Egla Arufa, a parsha that has absolutely nothing to do with war. When you find a John Doe dead and abandoned, we measure the closest city and we do this procedure called Egla Arufa. Why is this section dropped right in the middle of the various sections that relate to war? Furthermore, when you look at the parsha of Mashuach Muhammad itself, the Torah identifies four exemptions for fighting in a war, but only one whose logic is obvious. The Torah says that a timid person cannot fight in a war. I get that. If a soldier is not brave, he is not much of a soldier at all. That seems very logical. The Yare Virach Halevav will be a liability in the battlefield to himself and to his comrades. However, the guy who just built a house, the guy who just got married, the guy who just planted a vineyard, why are they exempt? How are we supposed to understand why they don't have to fight in the war? How many of them would even get off from jury duty for such an excuse? Sorry, I just moved. I just got a new house, so I can't be on jury duty. I don't even think we'd be exempted from jury duty for such a thing. And we're going to be exempt from fighting in a milchama for the Jewish people? So how do we understand these exemptions? And a third question. Rashi tells us that the three gifts from a shechted animal that go to a Kohen, the Zroa, the Chayayim, the Keva, are awarded to Kohanim in the merit, in the Zechus of Pinchas. Since Vayikach Romach Biyado, so he was Zochet to the Zroa, the arm of the animal. Since he davened before acting, he used his mouth to daven, he was Zochet to the Chayayim, the cheeks of the animal. Since he stabbed the woman, El Kevasa, his descendants merited the Keva of the animal. So what's the deeper connection over here? Why do we need three gifts to honor Pinchas's single act of bravery? So I think there's an important yisod over here. When a person reads the obligations of war, we run the risk of not fully appreciating how much the Torah values human life. As we describe the halachos of war, we start to think that wars are natural, its casualties are just part of life. You know, there are always going to be victims in war, and that's just the way the world goes. Somebody told me that as a child, he always assumed that most people died from wars and from direct gunshot wounds. Obviously, that's a person who watched too much television, but it's important that the Torah remind us just how much the Torah values human life, and that death is not normal, that wars are not the expectation. The parsha of Egla Arufa highlights how big a deal it is when somebody dies, the value of human life. An anonymous person who obviously wasn't very connected with people is found dead, and the Sanhedrin HaGadol Shebi Yerushalayim has to be bothered to come out, followed by the Sanhedrin of the closest city and a representative group of Kohanim to deal with this one anonymous stranger who doesn't seem to be missed very much. No one seems to be looking for him. The busiest and most powerful people in our community have to address the situation. And specifically in the context of the halachos of war, a reminder of the value of life is very much in order. I mean, how much more of a reminder do we have than what we've experienced over the past couple of years? Now, unfortunately, now we're seeing the coronavirus returning a little bit with this Delta variant. It should be something that lo aleinu should not take any more human life, and certainly not any more Jewish life. And we should all be safe. But we see the extent to which, good, responsible Talmidei Chachamim and Jewish leadership was involved in making sure to protect human life and making sure to protect Pikuach Nefesh, and how that's the highest value, because we are shaken to the core, even when there's this one person, abandoned guy. Who was he? A Nebuch, a schlepper. We don't know who he was. He was an anonymous person. And even so, the most important people in the community have to be the ones to deal with it. And maybe the three curious exemptions from war relate to a similar idea. When we go into a city to conquer and destroy, we remind everybody, both those who are going to go home and those who will fight, that Judaism values building over destroying. Judaism says that if you're about to build a house, a family, a vineyard, your contribution is greater there than it is on the battlefront, because we are fundamentally a positive and productive people. That's who Klal Yisrael is, even as, of course, we recognize the need for war, the need for destruction and loss of life on occasion. But we make that statement at the beginning of the war, that if you're someone who's about to build, if you're someone who's about to advance in a positive way, that's always going to take precedence over war. And maybe that explains the message of the Zroa L'Chayayim V'Keva. There were three stages in Pinchas's action, and we need to break it down into its component parts. First, Pinchas took the Romach Biyado, a clear reaction to what he saw. And then he acted by taking out the vengeance of God to be Nokem Nikmas Hashem. But there was a critical step in between the two. He davened to make sure that that act would not diminish his appreciation of human life and goodness. And for that, he was zocha to the L'chayayim. And maybe by breaking it down into its three parts, the Torah is highlighting to us the value of taking a moment before we do something that is a great mitzvah, but is somewhat destructive, is a loss of life, to remember that we daven to the Ribbono Shel Olam, that we should not lose an appreciation of what it means to have human life, of what it means to be productive and to be positive people, because fundamentally, we are a positive religion. Fundamentally, asei dochalos asei. That's what Klal Yisrael is. We're builders, we're not destroyers. Elamai, there are certain situations that are forced upon us, where even Klal Yisrael is forced into war. So I think that that might be one message of that, at least this section of Parsha Shoftim. Okay, now we're going to go to the, I guess David calls it the riddle of the week. We'll just say two kashas that we're going to ask. We're not going to have three this week, just two. Pasuk says that in Parsha Shoftim, Perek Yates, Pasuk Yitzayin, Va'amdu shnei ha'anashim asher lahem hariv. And Rashi writes, Va'amdu shnei ha'anashim be'edim ha'kosim adaber, v'limei che'en edus b'nashim. That it's talking about edim. And from here we learn that there's no edus by nashim. Rashi gets it from a Gemara in Shavuos Daf Lamed, that the Pasuk is excluding nashim because they're not kosher le'edus. Problem is, Gemara Baba Kamet has Vav Amir Aleph has a limud from the Pasuk, Ish Awisha, asher yasu mikol chatos ha'adam, that hishva kosim of Ishul to Ishul Kalonshim Shabbatorah, that we treat men and women equally for all the los asays in the Torah, that women are punished for all averos in the Torah. But the question is, why does the Gemara need such a limud? Shouldn't we be able to learn from our pasuk that women are punished for all averos in the Torah? Because if they weren't, then I don't need a pasuk to be mima'it women from edus. They would of course be excluded from edus, because kol edus shi'at yochla azima, any edus that you can't punish people for being edim zom minan on account of would not be a kosher edus. So of course women couldn't be edim if women couldn't be punished. If women couldn't be punished, then every edus that women would offer would be edus shi'at yochla azima. So mela women would be pasul edus. So why is the very fact that I need a limud to tell me that women are pasul edus, L'chora already teaches me that Tishva Kosav Yishal Ish L'kol Onshim Shabbatorah, that women are included in the Onshim Shabbatorah. That is question number one. Question number two. Pasuk says, Peruchav, Pasuk Chav, Rak Eitz Asher Teda Kilo Eitz Machal Hu Oso Tashchis. That there's an Isra Bal Tashchis, where you're not allowed to cut down a fruit-bearing tree. And what kind of tree can you cut down? a tree asher teida, that you know that it's not a fruit-bearing tree. Now, there is a well-known machlokas rishonim, the Shmaitza quotes, where the sveik daraisa l'chumra, the din that we pass in l'chumra on a safik daraisa, is itself a din daraisa or a din drabanan. Shitas Rambam in the ninth parak of Tumas Meis, halachi beis, is that it's only a din midrabanan, that on a daraisa level, even a safik daraisa would be l'kula. It's only the rabbanan who say that a safik daraisa l'chumra. But that shitas Rambam requires a little clarification, because it seems that this pasuk tells us that safik daraisa l'chumra. Because what does the pasuk say? You're not allowed to cut down a fruit-bearing tree. And what if I don't know if it's a fruit-bearing tree? Pasuk is clear. You're not allowed to cut it down. You have to go l'chumra. What does it say? Rak eitz asher teida kilo eitz machalu oso sashkus. You're only allowed to destroy it if you know for sure that it's not a fruit-bearing tree. Sounds like misafik, a person would have to be machmir. That sounds like it's a din midaraisa. So those are our two questions for this week. As always, you can call in, and whatever the methods are, the normal methods are to write in and to call in to share your answers for the riddles of the week. And with that, we move on to our show.
To leave a message, call 732-806-8700 and press number 2, or email at info@headlinesbook.com.
All right, we are so happy to welcome to the program Rabbi Moshe Taub, who's been on the program before together with David, but I think this might be the first time we've spoken on this program together, if I'm not mistaken. And welcome, Rabbi Taub. It's so wonderful to speak with you. I wanted to talk to you really about, mostly about kashrus-related issues when it comes to non-kashrus-related issues, meaning how kosher kashrus agencies or even local rabbanim should handle things that are not, you know, directly kashrus-related. And obviously, it's, you know, the starting point of that will be the beautiful article that you wrote relating to the Ben and Jerry's situation. But before we get to that, just because I just saw another article that you wrote something about Jackie Mason and how you had the opportunity to speak with him. Can you just, maybe for those who didn't see the article, give us a little color, a little bit of the background of how you got to Jackie Mason and what your impressions were after that conversation?
Yeah, I mean, it was fascinating. I'm not one, as I pointed out in the article, who is obsessed or knowledgeable about fame and the aura that it brings. It was not on my radar. He was not on my radar. Certainly, like every good from Jew, we've heard of him. And rumblings of his flumkeit. Happens to be that his father, in the words of a Shlomo Singer, the Shiva of the Pesach Torah Institute, it was on the level of Ramesha. His father was a tremendous Talmud Chacham, a Rav in America. He came over. And in my research of American Rabbanim, which I write in Ami magazine in the summers, a Balabas, who's actually friendly, a Balabas in my shul, who's friendly with him, the Masons, set up this interview. It was supposed to be 5 minutes over the phone. It turned out a 10-minute meeting over coffee, which eventually turned into a very lengthy lunch that we had together in a nice kosher restaurant in Manhattan. My goal, in addition to finding out about his rabbanus, the listener has to know that he left Ramesha when Ramesha's beard was black. And as a single young man, he was a rav in two very small communities without a mikvah. And I wanted to hear, stam, irrespective of who he became, what Rabbanus was like for a single man in early America, what the Balabatim were like, and what I didn't mention in the article. The truth is, before writing it, I hadn't listened to the recording. I recorded the lunch, and I was listening to it again last week, and he talked about how coming from New York, the out-of-town Balabatim, it was not night and day, which I experienced myself. Balabatim in New York are wonderful, but there's something very special about out-of-town Balabatim. And it was very interesting hearing this confirmed by none other than Jackie Mason. And he talked about his other time in Rabbanus and you know, the cliche Jackie Mason concept of more Gentiles coming to drushes than Jews was true, and Nebuchadnezzar got chatayitahaga. I mean, this is not the sugya of people who go off the derech and how they're viewed today, but the Fira Meisha, it's very his own Rebbe, as opposed to the Chazay Nish, it's hard to view him lightly, and we have to say that we're not supporting Chalila in any way. What he did, it's horrible, and it was a Chilul Hashem, especially from where he came from. But really, that was my whole goal. My whole goal was to talk about Reb Moshe. I know he has from family members, many of them, and I'm sure they're aware of this. But to think about Jackie Mason and Reb Moshe, I wanted to hear. So a few things I'll share with the listener. Reb Moshe loved Jackie Mason, Yaakov Moshe. He saw something in him, clearly, a certain kayach that we all know he had. In the middle of a shir, Shlomo Singer told me this. Shlomo Singer went by Reb Moshe at the same time, and then he was the one who transcribed the Baron's, the Mishnah of Baron really comes from Reb Singer, whose chavrus is with the Baron's son, the next Rosh Hashiva. In any event, so he told me in the middle of shir, Reb Moshe would stop and say, "Nu Yaakov Moshe, nu," with a big shmecha, with a big smile, as if he's asking Jackie Mason if he enjoyed the chiddush. And he always, Reb Moshe, I don't think I mentioned this in the article, would ask whenever there was an event, an Eineg, Melava Malka, in the yeshiva among the Bacharim, he would always ask Mason to speak because the Bacharim always laughed. And the words of the singer, Reb Moshe didn't understand a word he was saying, but he loved to see the Bacharim smile, which was a beautiful thing to hear. But at the very end of the meeting, and this is really the whole point of this article, which, by the way, I never meant to write. The Jewish press called about the Ben and Jerry's sugya, and after I wrote it, I said, by the way, I have this interview. Would you want it? And of course, they wanted it. So at the end of the interview, I wanted to ask. Now, I should point out, and I said this in the interview, many rabbanim who heard that I was meeting with him wanted me to ask this 93-year-old if he regrets, if he misses, if he longs, if he pines for Torah. You have to remember, as rabbanim, balabatim, whoever is listening, just because someone is known to the world, he's not a serf. And they are private individuals, and you can't penetrate their neshama just because you have one lunch. But there's a way with tichlus to get to that. So I asked him, this is the question, this is the crescendo. When was the last time you saw Reb Moshe? And that question could take many different avenues. Maybe he'll regret the last time was in the 50s. He did mention that he still has his smicha. I asked him point blank, do you still have the piece of paper, the actual smicha? He said, of course he does. I was hoping he would pull it out, but that didn't happen. So he said, the last time I saw Reb Moshe, he thinks for a moment, and it's hard to hear on the tape. Ironically, strangely, me and Jackie Mason were sharing a plate of French fries at the time, so there's a lot of noise and dipping and ketchup. And he thinks and he says, when was the last time, when was Reb Moshe, and the sound is unclear, but he asked, when was he Nifter? I don't remember if he used the word Nifter. But I responded, I was listening to the recording, 1986, as we all know, he was Nifter at Tainus Esther. So he thought again for a moment, and he said, 82, 83, 84. I said, 1984? I thought, when he left and became famous and on the Ed Sullivan show, that was it. He never went back to Reb Moshe. But apparently, and he said, he would visit Reb Moshe once, if not twice a year. He would go to MTJ, put on the yarmulke, and meet with Reb Moshe. And he said, and these words, he said, and David, David, his son? I said, David, David Feinstein? Yeah, he was just Nifter. David was just Nifter at the time. I said, of course, he was. David was my chaver. He was my friend in yeshiva. But David and I would speak throughout the year after he left Tyra, at least once a year, if not twice a year. Sometimes I would call him. Sometimes he would call me. And I said, what would you talk about? He said, showbiz. I said, I didn't put this in the article. I said, showbiz? And he said, Reb Dover would ask me, what does it take to be a comedian? What do you have to do? And I said to him that I stand up on the stage for an hour and a half. When I did my Broadway show, Reb Dover called me up and said, how long is the show? I said, an hour and a half. And he joked, I offered him tickets. I offered him my show tickets. And he laughed. He goes, of course, I knew they weren't going to take them. And Reb Dover said to me, how could you get up and speak for an hour and a half straight? To which I said to Reb Dover, I said, David, when you give a shear, how long is your shear for? And he laughed on the other end of the line and said, you're right. And then he continued and said, David, your shear's every day. I repeat the same thing. So you have the harder job. And then he looked at me and he said, you want to know if they asked me if I put on film, tissues? He said, they only showed me love. And then Jackie Mason uttered these words to me. Do you know the phrase, Oyev es chaveroi? That was the fine thing. Oyev es chaveroi. And, to conclude the story, because obviously there are people, I'm sure, know the Mason better than I. It was just one interview. It might have been his last. But I was speaking to my Balabatim about the story, and I was asking them and challenging myself and them, what's the lesson of this story? Because there's a mitzvah of Achayech Techich Banisecha. I know people who are from today. You serve in Rabbanus as well. There are people who come in who are not so from, and the Rav hands them a pair of tzitzis and says, you know, when you're ready, hands them a pair of tefillin. When you're ready to come in, I'll show you how to wear them. You taka is supposed to draw them in. So what is the lesson? So I don't know what Rav Moshe and Rav David recognized. They knew him very well. They knew the family very well. For whatever reason, they understood that trying to bring him back might turn him off. For whatever reason. But what we do see is that Rav Moshe, who loved Torah more than anything else, Rav David, who loved Torah more than anything else, was able to bite his tongue when he felt it was a time for love. And it's such a Musar Haskil in our personal lives when we can't keep our mouths shut, when we think we have to bring up time. Not every time has to be mentioned. We can only imagine the tears that Rav Moshe cried over this Talmud, who, according to the Shlomo Singer, he really, really loved. I was speaking to Rabbi Kamenetsky of South Shore, just to demonstrate how Rav Moshe loved him and how he had an influence before he left. He described an influence that we feel today, that Rabbi Kamenetsky's illustrious father, Rabbi Kamenetsky's son, when he came over from Europe, didn't speak English, or at least not well. And I believe they were living in the Lower East Side at the time. And this actually, the story is in Rabbi Kamenetsky's book. I don't think this book is available in stores, The History of the Five Towns, a wonderful coffee table, huge book with wonderful pictures and stories. And I think there as well, it's shared. But he said that he went to the Lower East Side and he went to MTJ. And eventually he was sent to Jackie Mason. Yaakov Moshe Mason was teaching third grade at the time, I believe. First, second, third. He was teaching English. And Mordechai Kamenetsky's father, who was, I think, 19 at the time, sat in on a 16-year-old Jackie Mason teaching English. I don't know if Mordechai's father learned English with the same Jewish accent as Jackie Mason. It would be funny if he did.
I was
going
to
like
say,
it.
If you learned English from Jackie Mason, then it's not exactly the Queen's English.
to say the least. So that's the Maisa, and it's just, you never know from whom you'll learn a tale from Gedolim, who could be a bridge to the past. One other Musar from the story, if I may, Rabbi Leibowitz, is, you know, we live in a generation. My wife points this out all the time. She always says that the problem today in our dar is a lack of hakaras hatayim. And when she said that to me, I never understood what she meant. She blames going up to Derech, all the issues on hakaras hatayim. That meeting with Jackie Mason changed my mind to agree with my wife. We live in a generation where people leave Torah, they leave, and they talk in such horrible and untrue ways about their past. Hamev and Yavin, what I'm referring to in the news or in the media over the past few weeks. And he was of a generation that, although whatever Yitzhak Haraz he had, we're not the ultimate judge and jury, that's only up to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, he never forgot his Rebbe, and he never forgot Ahava. So it's a lesson of the power of Ahava, but also of HaKadosh HaTayv. No matter who you are in life and what station you're at, you don't have to bring someone else down to make yourself feel more comfortable in your shoes.
Yeah, I mean, I would just add along the same lines, one of the great challenges when someone, you know, when someone essentially goes off the derech, I mean, as much as, you know, Jewish people tend to be tickled when one of our own, you know, becomes famous or something like that, this is a profoundly sad story that, that you know, he gave up on Shmir's Torah mitzvahs, but the ability of those who were close to him to keep him with positive feelings toward the community that he came from and toward his background, since he came from a family of generations of Rabbanim. And that continues through his brothers and their children. I mean, but to keep positive feelings, even though he so clearly broke from that entire tradition, that's no small feat. I mean, that must have been a lot of love from Rav Moshe, from Rav David, from other people that were around him, to make sure that because the Chilul Hashem could have been exponentially worse if he would have had very negative feelings about the community that he came from.
I heard on that point, I believe it's that wonderful point you just made. I heard a Messiah for Rav Moshe. As we know, the Rabbanim, not everything Rav Moshe said was written in Shuvas. The Mashallah had to deal with certain Gazavans on Yom Tov, the Chule, Amir and Yavin. One of the things that he told Talmidim, I never was able to verify this. In Europe, they would sit Shiva when someone went off the Derech. In America, the family would disown. let's say they married a guy, Chalila Rachmana Litzlan, the family would disown, but there was a minhag that one family member would stay in touch. So Rav Moshe told Talmidim closer to the end of his life that now it has to be switched. Everybody stays in touch. One family member should never speak to them again, just to stand on principle. That's Aush. And Satan's, you know, we live in a generation that's very, it's a very interesting haara. But I was never able to verify it. They're not giving up sack. But the other haara on what you said is, we live in a time that we're spoiled. It's a bad term to use. So many yidden in show business and in all these areas of secular culture who were never raised religious. The reform conservative world is dying. Our kids, and certainly our grandchildren, the only famous people in the media, because they're Jerry Seinfeld, LaMarshall, I don't know, whoever it may be, their grandchild probably won't be Jewish, just the odds are. The famous people in culture in 20, 30, 50 years will have to be, unfortunately, if they exist, Mashiach hasn't come, those who left Torah. This is going to be the future of famous celebrities. It's all going to be Yidden who left Torah. We're already seeing it today with I don't want to name the person who a documentary that's becoming popular. So this is going to be a challenge, and hopefully we won't have to deal with it with the arrival of Mashiach Tzidkenu.
Amen. Also, just one more point. I do not want to make this conversation about Jackie Mason, but just one more point. I don't remember if it was in your article or somewhere else. I saw somewhere that he didn't, his father never knew that he went into show business because he didn't want to disappoint his father. He didn't want to upset his father. And his father was just, his head was in the svarim all day. He was a Talmid Chacham, and he wouldn't be watching on television or anything. He wasn't even aware that his son was doing this, and that was by design because he knew how upsetting it would be to his father. And I think that also speaks to a certain sensitivity that when someone, Nebuch, you know, makes these decisions in his life, to have the respect, you know, for a parent who's not only Shomer Torah Mitzvot, but a Talmid Chacham, to not want to upset them and give them more agnas nefesh than they probably already had. Although I wonder if his father really didn't know or if that was just something that he believed.
Wow, that's amazing. You know, I don't know if you have to deal with this, Nebuch, but in the Rabbanus, and as a kain, I give you a brach, if you have to deal with this. But when children are going out to derech and they meet with the rabbi, one thing I always say, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work, and they challenge about God, and you don't need Torah for virtue, and you don't need Torah for midas. And so I asked them, I said, so you don't need Torah to tell you that you shouldn't make your mother cry? You don't need Torah to tell you that your father shouldn't have to lock himself in the bathroom so his wife doesn't have to see him shed tears? If you really believe that you don't need Torah for virtue, then how are you doing this to your parents? At least pretend. If you want to be a true secular Baal Midos, I'll never understand. I try to. Not that children have the Yetzer Hara, but you know, today we have a society that people could be happy. Nebuch, without Torah mitzvahs, I think they're happy. But the Tahara of doing this, allowing this to overwhelm a Yiddish mama and her tears by Halakas Ne'er Shabbos is very painful, very difficult to understand.
Yeah, painful indeed. I want to shift the conversation a little bit to what we really came to talk about, and that is, Ben and Jerry's made very unfortunate headlines with their essential association with the BDS movement and their decision not to sell in Yehuda v'Shomron. And there's been a lot of discussion about whether such a company is deserving of hashkacha, deserving of a kashrut certification. Now, before we even start the conversation, begadol, you know, like bigger picture, and you know what types of considerations should be taken into account as far as kashrus, I just do want to point out that the certifying agency for Ben and Jerry did issue a letter, a public letter, where they said, and I think a lot of people don't realize this, don't know this, that they have been in contact with the Israeli government and with the Yesha Council to determine, I'm reading from the letter, the most effective way to respond. Based on the advice of the Yesha Council, this organization will continue to fulfill its contractual obligations to Ben & Jerry's while using its influence to make sure that this anti-Israel policy never becomes implemented. And it goes on to say that everyone should advocate on behalf of Israel, but address your concerns directly to Unilever and to Ben & Jerry's. It's a volatile situation, and the Hashgacha agency remains in contact with the Israeli government and with the Yesha Council as the most prudent way to make sure the policy never becomes implemented, which is fascinating to me, meaning they are not saying that we're ignoring this because it's a non-kashrus issue. They're saying we're paying careful attention to this, and we believe that this is the best way to go about handling the situation. So I just want to make that point. Do you have any comments on that point, on that letter?
It reminds me of all people, whatever your politics are, George W. Bush once said that all the campaigning for president and all the vitriol and all the hyperbole, it all falls to the wayside the first time you sit down at your desk at the Oval Office. You know, there are so many people who are cynical toward the world of kashrus. Now, I used to be in the world of kashrus. I ran the VAD, both a local VAD that also had hands nationally, internationally. I'm not involved in kashrus, I would say Baruch Hashem, just because I have other things on my plate anymore. But people have to realize it's very easy to Monday morning quarterback. The people involved in kashrus, and in particular the kashrus organization that certifies Ben & Jerry's, are filled with Tamidei Chachamim, very serious people who have to make a decision, not on Twitter, but a decision that affects our lives and other people's lives in very serious ways. And it's a reminder, and that letter should be a reminder to the audience of who is running this organization and their level of seriousness and dedication to the tzibur.
Okay. Now, what I'd like to do with you is you wrote a very fascinating article. It was forwarded to me by several people. You know, there were some local kashrus issues that we've been dealing with that some people thought your article might shed light on some of those issues. I thought your article was a totally separate topic, but that's not the discussion for now. I want to really just go through your article and the arguments that you made and, you know, maybe give a little pushback so that, you know, so you can better clarify your points. I mean, it was very clear, but maybe just to give a little pushback, you know, lahagdil tor lahadir, I guess, to discuss the points that you made. So we'll start with this. Before we get into the actual arguments that you made, you wrote that Ben & Jerry's decision to let politics overwhelm and direct its food product distribution choices should not be answered by us demanding we do the same. Now, it is pretty clear that your opinion is, and I think all of our opinion is, that Ben & Jerry's did the wrong thing over here. I guess my question for you is, before we get into your arguments, is there ever a situation where a company should allow politics to determine its business practices, meaning, or non-business related issues? Meaning, if a company finds something immoral, whether they're right or wrong, is that not within a company's rights or a company's moral obligations to act on that? Is that just like a general thing that they shouldn't let politics overwhelm them?
Well, the point of that opening statement is because of the seriousness of the BDS movement that, you know, we've always been concerned about in the Jewish community and those that are more involved. Zionistically and together with the State of Israel, especially in my shul, and I'm sure yours as well, understand that the BDS movement is not just wrong, but it could severely impact. The domino effect is severe. So when Ben & Jerry's decides to do this, there was a concern among those who follow these issues closely that this could snowball. Because as we know today in culture and Twitter wars, there is the competition online, especially for companies to out-progress of each other. So what I meant by that point is the same way, the same argument, the correct argument, that what Ben & Jerry's decided to do is not about, you know, Cherry Garcia and chocolate chip cookie dough, not about ice cream. This could severely impact Israel because there's a domino effect. Nothing lives in a vacuum. Recognize that the same domino effect works the other way. That was the point of that argument, that if you do this, and many of the points in the latter part of your question will be affected, then now we're going to have to recognize all moral issues within companies. Now, there's still a shailush, I'm sure you're going to ask, when does a VAD have to refrain? And that's a tough, you know, by Shalosh Shudis, it's the funny thing. You know, you don't want to focus on Jackie Mason, initially, I thought no one even knew about the Ben & Jerry's article because the Jackie Mason article eclipsed. It was passed around so fast that by Shelley Shudis, I was becovered, attacked in a nice way by the shul. You know, could you explain this argument and that argument? And one of the points, one of the balabats it made, what if the PLO calls you up and says they want you to give hashgacha? So I joked, I said, well, I'm not a kasher anymore. I'll tell them. No, but seriously, what if a white supremacist? What if the KKK? Well, certainly if a vod feels unsafe, they have every right not to give hashgacha. But these are very difficult questions.
There are major kashrus organizations that will not give a hashgacha, not only not on a casino, but not in a city where that is known for its casinos. Is that incorrect? Is that improper? Or let's say, you know, there are places, I think we would all agree that places that are, you know, built for the purpose of arayos, again, the Hamed and Yavin, the kinds of places you find near airports sometimes, that if they wanted a hashgacha, it would be such a chil Hashem to provide a hashgacha. And I think everyone would agree with that. Where do we draw the line?
I don't know. I've been thinking about this, and obviously after I wrote the column, and as I was writing it, I mean, in the column, just to be clear and to really challenge myself, I challenge the reader by saying, you know, either you want your vod to be involved in moral issues or you don't. So the example I gave is a pizza shop that's open past 9 p.m. on Matzah Shabbos. I know of a vod who won't give certification, a city that never had successful restaurants, because they won't allow this. Now, is the vod correct that it's going to be a hangout? Absolutely. Who are we fooling? Ain't that be trouble slur right? Are they correct that you can't give a hashgacha? So in the article, it was very elementary and simplistic. You can't complain about one, that's pull Ben and Jerry's. But the question on myself and really any rav, and especially any vad agency, is, okay, so what is that line? I don't know. I mean, I've been thinking about this for a week. I don't know what that line is. Certain, you know, the example I gave there, and I'll give a more detail here, is Rabashka. You know, we don't stand there, but everybody knows the story of Rabashka. Leaving aside all the details, guilty, innocent, what happened, what didn't happen, the fact of the matter is the conservative movement and a movement within the conservative movement started the Hechsher Tzedek, Ethical Kashrus Council. Their goal being, they're going to make sure it's not just kosher according to your Yerodeya, but also Chayshim Mishmat. That was very foolish, because now, if you certify a subsidiary of Enron, it's a chilul Hashem on you. Now you're right. Now, first of all, no company, no conglomerate is going to allow this to happen. So the whole thing is a Mickey Mouse pipe dream. It's Pollyannish. But that being said, so you really want to protect liability. That's number one. You want to be different enough to protect liability.
Can I give a little pushback on that? I think there's a difference to be, there's a distinction to be made between claiming that you can watch over everything and that you can be a mashkiach on a person's moral character and on their choshen mishpat and on their, versus saying, you know what, this is just not a company that I want to be associated with, nor do I think this is a company that, you know, from people should be associated, that Jewish people should be associated with. Meaning, I don't think the argument people were making was that the hashkacha should be mashkiach over the woke policies of the organization, which is what that conservative hashkacha that you're referring to is suggesting to do. I think it's saying, we just don't want to be associated with someone who's going to be involved in BDS.
The problem with that argument, I mean, let me say two things. First of all, I think the major distinction between pulling hashkacha, or better said, not giving hashkacha, versus giving, is if there's an actual halacha as opposed to prevention. A hangout, we all have a yetzer hara, but we also have the yetzer tov. You're not actually providing something also. Whereas your airport example, there's an actual Isser in Shulchan Aruch. So I think that will be the first line of defense. As to your second point, that this is not a company we feel comfortable doing business with, as I point out in the article, that too is a slippery slope. I gave the example that every winter, I call it quote-unquote winter, but we all know what season I'm talking about. When I go to CVS to fill a prescription, I love buying their candy canes. And it has a hashgacha on it, and so does Easter Bunny. We cannot, especially as Rabbanim, not just people in support of Eretz Yisroel, but as Rabbanim, discard. And I'm not, by the way, in favor of hashgachas being removed from Easter Bunny. That being said, we cannot, as Rabbanim, discard one of the animamim, I mean, think about what the Easter Bunny represents, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself birthed a child. Think about what this is, that the state of BDS eclipses that. I at least, in good conscience, can't do that. So now where does that leave us? Perhaps there has to be a systematic set of rules that are made, but it's a very slippery, you know, I want to give an example. I didn't put this in the article. Years ago, when I was in Kashrus, I was living in Buffalo at the time, and I was trying to grow the VAD to be more national, international. For financial reasons, you want to be, you know, more sustainable. And Baruch Hashem, we were Matzliach, and we would get calls. We would actually, you know, VAD didn't get calls to go under Hashgacha. That's the way it should be, as opposed to the other way around. And one company calls us up. They have a farm, and the farm happened to be near Western New York. So I didn't know what they wanted exactly. I drive to the farm. It was a greenhouse. What do they make? They make tomatoes. Tomatoes. I said, okay, what can we do for you? There was no Tulayim issue without getting into the details of Hilchos Tulayim. He said, well, you know, to get into a store, there are a number of checklists. So are you organic? Are you kosher certified? You know, all these other things. The higher up on the checklist, the more checks you have, the better chance you get to be in the store, and the better shelf space you get, because sociologists have studies of what you see first in the aisle. There's a whole research on this issue. So, and they offered a lot of money. I went back to my president and I said, we can't certify them. And initially he was upset, understandably. Why would you give up, you know, whatever it was, $10,000 a year? I said, if we start certifying tomatoes within, you know, 7 years, this is going to be a new industry, and no firm person is going to buy cucumbers without a hashgacha. I could give examples. I don't want to. Because
you do have major cosmos organizations that certify water, you know, so, I mean, not everyone made that.
It's a funny story. It's interesting. My first week when I moved to Buffalo, 2003, I was 24 years old. Wet behind the ears doesn't describe it. I was wet all over my body. And my first company I visited that I yarshened was a water company. And I go to the water company and I'm looking at their fluoride. I'm looking at all the minerals they put into it. And I'm researching, and my shver, who's a kashrus expert and a chemistry expert, I'm on the phone with him. And I'm so busy with this. Then I realize, one second, they put fluoride in tap water. Every mineral I was looking at is in tap water. What am I even doing? So water's an issue, although, you know, a kashrus agency could defend this any number of ways. I mean, Dasani, there are certain water companies that are owned by conglomerates, and you do want to make sure that their reverse osmosis machines and other machines aren't utilized for other things. The listener has to know, most companies, now, not the Coca-Colas of the world, not the Unilevers of the world, but most companies are dieted down, you know, category B to F company. They don't buy production material new. That costs millions and millions of dollars. They buy it used. So even something like a cannery machine that just cooks up the vegetables that are in the can. And people always ask Rabbanim, why do canned vegetables as opposed to fruit need a very good hashgacha? Well, they're put in the cannery and they're cooked in the can. We have no idea, A, if Spam is being cooked at the same time, but more importantly, that machine was probably purchased from all you know from a dog food company. So there are issues that could be involved even with water, but that being said, I don't know if everybody in the kashrus world would agree with my rejection of tomatoes. Maybe they will, maybe they won't. The reason why I bring that story as an example, and I think the listener might be interested just to hear the world of kashrus, is because of the domino effect. And you make these decisions about BDS, it's not going to end there, because the world does not end by the Verrazano Bridge. Lakewood has their own titans, hashkafically. And Atlanta and Toronto and every city and every Jew has their own hashgachas from their own rebbeim, their own things they take very seriously. And you want to protect, you know, Rabbi Leibowitz, if you don't mind, let me share a very quick story. I know the tomato story was a story, but here's another story. Years ago, I think the first case was in 1914, New York State, as well as other states, began something called the kosher state law. In other words, they have someone who works for the state who will visit companies. If you advertise as kosher, the state wants to protect the consumer and make sure that it's really kosher. And this still exists today. And when I was in kashrus, the last person who held this position was from Ben Teira, Talmud Chacham. This is not a comment on them. That being said, why would anybody be against it? This is wonderful, right? And we all supported this. until the 70s. And there were other court cases before this. I'm not going to go through the history. I think the first case was in 1920. But the major case was in the 70s in Long Island. Two brothers, conservative, with a conservative rabbi certifying. The New York State came in and said, you have to be Orthodox according to the Shulchan Aruch. This is not according to the Cairo Code. And we're pulling your ability to announce as kosher, maybe also fine them. And they sued. And of course they won. Because how could any court, based on our constitution, the separation of church and state, allowed it. So why am I telling you to listen to the story? Because in 2014, and really up until that point, it's a much longer story, they formalized the new set of rules for New York State kosher law. And now what the law is as follows. If I advertise as kosher, and the New York State says, what gives you the right to say you're kosher? And I say, well, I read a kosher cookbook in 1942, then that's the level they'll check me on. If I say I'm Orthodox, they could find me. So when I was in Buffalo, LaMushel, there was Top Supermarket, which was supervised by the VAD. Across the street was Wegmans. Wegmans was not supervised. There was a reform cantor who would visit once a year. They had a kosher, quote-unquote, counter where they served rotisserie chicken. Mamish, forget Bishel Akum, it could be Trey. The kosher inspector would come, and he would say, my hands are tied with them because they claim to be reforms. They could do whatever they want. But with you, if I find an issue, I could fine you. And in fact, he once found a can of tomato sauce with pork, and he wanted to fine $10,000 until I ran to the store and I realized there was no pork in it. It was a suggested recipe in the back to add pork. But the point being, here you have something that seems like such a good idea, such a good idea. And it took about 80 years to realize that it could come back to haunt us. By the way, kosher laws may still be necessary. Maybe it's still good that we have to advertise as Orthodox or Reform or conservative. This is not bashing kosher laws, although I don't understand why it's just kosher. Why don't they stand under the chuppah, New York State, to make sure it's a shavapruta? I never understood why this is their focus, but okay. But here you have an example of something so simply an elementary positive that could come back to haunt us. And I think with Ben and Jerry, certainly, if we open this Pandora's box to a public discussion of which moralities a hashgacha should certify, we're in big trouble. Will there be times that a hashgacha will pull because of a moral issue? We gave the example, I didn't say what it was, but it was a gay event, a homosexual event. I don't know exactly what it was in Flatbush, where the VAD pulled out, and this very same people who were upset then want Ben and Jerry's pulled. I don't know what the answer is. I think place may have to be talked to. Ramesha, for example. Well, let me finish the point. But we as the consumer have to trust that kashrus experts know the market. And they know the market. And, you know, we walk into the stores. I'll never forget as a bacher, there was a store in Toronto where I was growing up called Kosher City. And there was a very left-leaning guy, Tom Chacham, but he always liked to challenge me when I came back from yeshiva. It was Bain of Manim. I was standing in line behind him in Kosher City. And as he was checking out, he says, what do the rabbis do for me? And I was looking at the onion rings and the steak and the potato chips and the Coca-Cola he was purchasing. And I said to him, how could you say such a thing? Do you have any idea the amount of Torah that went into your shopping list? So I don't know what the answer is, where the line is, but we have to drop our cynicism and trust the agencies that have been involved in kashrus for many decades, that they know where that line is. Sometimes there's a book called Moonwalking with Einstein, a wonderful book written about 15 years ago by a secular Jew, happens to be, where he discusses the idea of knowledge that you can't define. There's certain expertise that we can't define. The kashrus, I wish they could come up with a simple rule where that line is, but we're going to have to trust that they know where that line is. The example I wanted to give,
that line is, might be different if you're dealing with a national or international hashkacha versus a communal hashkacha. Meaning, if there's a hashkacha in Lakewood, I think there would be an expectation from the Lakewood community that the Hashgacha live up to a certain standard or expect a certain standard that would not be expected in, my brother is a Rav in San Jose, California, for example. So it would not be expected in San Jose, California. Meaning that there is, we are in agreement that there is a line, and we are in agreement that there has to be a judgment call. The judgment call doesn't have to be the same for everybody.
I think, though, that when international... I know your brother's in San Jose. That sounds very nice. If you're looking for a scholar in residence, just throw my name in. In any event, when we're talking about the certification of international products, I think all Vadim have to be on the same page. Look, when it comes to Lakewood, Lamashal, for example, Ramesh's Tuva, which we dealt with when I ran Avad, because you have meat restaurants open during the 9 days. So in Buffalo, New York, if we would close that restaurant, people are going to eat shreif, which, by the way, if we stop certifying Ben and Jerry's, I wonder which person who wants Hashgacha pulled is going to take that spiritual thing on.
I wanted to push back on that point. You made that point in your article about Ben and Jerry's, and that what about all the non-religious people who are eating Ben and Jerry's now and are now eating kosher? If we were to pull the Hashgacha, then they wouldn't be eating kosher. Is that really something? Is that meaning? I know they say that Rav Avadia, Zichron Levracha, in Eretz Yisrael, was very makbid to try to provide at least a minimal kashrus. And the whole idea of Rabbanut Hashkacha, with all of its flaws, is to provide some sort of minimal standard for those who otherwise aren't keeping kosher. But is that really the achrayus of a strong kashrus organization? Meaning, leaving Ben and Jerry's aside, because Ben and Jerry's is not really a kashrus issue. But that same argument could be made that we should lower our kashrus standards so that we could provide hashgacha for as many companies as possible, so that the non-religious consumer will not be eating mamish treif. But is that really what we should be doing? Should the OU and should the TRC, should all of them just drop their standards so that everything can have hashgacha?
I don't think I'm a bar plukta on this, but I could tell you two quick mices. Number one is when I was again in Buffalo, because that's when I ran Avad, I called, I think I quoted Rav Shlomo Miller, who is by no means a Radernish or Paisik, probably a leading Paisik of the Haredi belt today. Meals on Wheels wanted to go kosher. Meals on Wheels, of course, services everybody. And there was no way that we could offer Mashkiach to meet this. There was, without getting into particulars, there was no way. Ayetiv and Nichnas, maybe. Basar Salman Ayin, there were so many clear halachic derabbanans that were problematic, at the very least here. But on the other hand, I didn't want to serve them. I didn't want to serve them trace. And he said that while we can't officially certify them, a letter of recommendation of what they should follow, and even a payment to us, would be allowed. That we do have some of that achrayus. But the second thing I want to point, I don't know where that line is. It's a very difficult one. But I think there's a distinction.
He said not to certify them, but to make recommendations to them.
I haven't thought about the story for a while. I don't remember if he allowed, because we wanted to use our imprimatur. There was a reason why our name needed to be attached. Maybe there was a donation from Federation. I don't remember what it was. And he allowed something as long as the word certification wasn't used, and he said that you're going to prevent many people from eating tarfis. So again, without this is a ma'aser rav, which I don't have the exact detail. I have to look at my notes, but which I don't have in front of me. That's number one. Number two is I think there's a distinction between not giving hashgacha. I don't think every vad, and again they could speak for themselves, and I'm not in kashrus now, has achrayas to make to go to lower the standards. Although, by the way, the OK certifies Philadelphia cream cheese. Now, the OK is run by Chabad, Lubavitchers, generally. I mean, that's the start. And I once asked him, how could you, I think it was yesterday, just a year or two ago, I said, how could you certify Cholestam? I mean, it's not Cholestam, it's Cholabakum, according to you. Cholestam, really, Cholodisro, according to the literature.
Right.
So he said, he asked the Rebbe, and the Rebbe told him that someone else is going to certify it anyway, so you might as well make sure that they're at least eating, to the best of their ability. So you have from now, you have from Shlomo Miller, and you have on the other end from Lubavitch Chassidim. But I think there's a distinction between going ahead and certifying and pulling Hashgacha. You know, there are people out there, and people in New York and Lakewood and Five Towns and Teaneck may not recognize this, especially if you're grown up FFB in the tri-state area. There are people who are Jew-ish. Yeah, they'll try to eat kosher. And they don't always check. And neither do I. I mean, how many times have I bought something and my daughter points out, oh, there's no you on it anymore? I think those people have to be considered. I remember once I was in Bangor, Maine, and there used to be, I don't know if it's still there, I had to be there for kashrus. Downtown Bangor, Maine, which is, the size of a few tefachim, but there was one major kosher restaurant, and I walk in, and they serve meat and dairy. And I spoke to the Rav, he seemed like a Yedei HaSefer, and there was Mashkiach Tamidi, So anyway, I walk downstairs. He gives me a whole tour, and I talk. I think I'm feeling comfortable. And then I see a Chassidish family walk in, and the Chassidish family is ordering and they're eating. And I say, okay, fine. So I order. But when I get my food, I'm on the way out. I turn to Chassidish Mishpacha. I say, I just want to give you Asher Kodesh. They say, why? I said, I wasn't sure if I could eat here, but I saw you eating here, and now I know I'm comfortable. He turns beet red. He stands up. Goes, what are you talking about? I saw you eating here, so I thought it was fine. That's why I'm eating here. There's a big napkin.
And that's how people make their kashrus decisions.
Right. It's true. Chavah Chavah's way is the most powerful tool. But the point being is that once the reputation is out of the bag, to pull it back in, I think that's an underachnite.
No, I agree that there's a big difference between not wanting to certify in the first place and pulling back a certification. I agree with that. I'm not really even pushing back on that. I did want to push back on one other thing. The very first argument you made in the article was that, you know, you wrote, you're betting on someone else's dime, meaning you take a bold stance against a company. There's a mashkiach that makes his living by certifying that company, and there are ingredients in that product that might be provided by Jewish companies or religious companies. So, you know, now all these people are going to be out of Parnassa, and you compared it to Rav Shlomo Kluger, who was very against machine matzos, and one of the arguments that a number of the poskim made against the innovation of machine matzos in the 1800s was that, you know, people who make hand matzos are going to lose their job. Is that really analogous to machine matzos? Meaning, if Jews were employed by a company that sold children into slavery, would we say, you know, no boycott is necessary because, you know, meaning there's a difference between two things that are that are kosher, and one of them is going to cost someone their job, and something that's just really fundamentally flawed and problematic. Meaning, there's nothing flawed with
There's a big naftamina. I would hope that most listeners would not be utilizing the children sold into slavery. The fact is, when it comes to that particular kashrus agency and many others, we have been, up until this point, for those Echol of Stam, utilizing those services. The people involved made financial decisions based on it. That's not a guzma. People like to think of kashrus agencies, you know, I don't know what they think of them. There are very hardworking men who make life decisions based on kashrus. I can't stress that enough. As an out-of-town rav, I'm in a unique position to share this with the listeners. We make unique, I'm not an out-of-town rav anymore, but at the time, we make decisions of moving or staying where we are based on these matters, that we all have a social contract. Every listener, each call of Stam, before this event has had Ben and Jerry's, to throw those people. We talked about Hakaras HaTayv at the beginning of this discussion. This is very different than something which was always wrong. This was not someone who was involved in something that was always wrong. And as I pointed out in my Shul Shalosh Shuvos, had people said, let us find Parnassa for these people. Let us, these mashkich, let's find out who they are and give them the same money out of our own pockets to make sure this happens, I would have taken it more seriously. But it showed, not from Chalilu, but from the others, a lack of understanding of how the cashless world works. Ben and Jerry's, you know,
that's fair,
Coca-Cola.
But people generally see what's in front of their face. They don't see, you know, it's hard to know the ripple effects of everything. And I think that point is an excellent point that you made, that there are ripple effects to everything. But maybe that doesn't mean that the answer is that. And again, I'm not making the argument one way or the other with the Ben and Jerry's issue. I'm just saying that the answer can't always be. Yeah,
that's a very fair point. But at the same time, look, it's very true, I mean, with what you're saying. My points are points to consider. As I said at the beginning of the article, they need to be said aloud. People need to be aware of them. There may be ways around, I think there are 7 points I make. There may be ways around all the points. Some of the points, at least when it comes to the financial stability of these people, you know, I always think of the Gemara with Acher, when after they exited Pardes, so Acher is with the Zayin, and the Zayin says, aren't you a chash of a rav? So what does he do? He pulls out grass from the ground or Shabbos. If you do that to a guy today, you know, they're not going to know that it has anything to do with Orthodoxy. Maybe if you drive on Shabbos. There was a time that agriculture, we understood where our food came from. Goyim, Yidden, and they associated even Hilchos Shabbos with it. My only point with your betting on someone else's dime is people have no idea what goes into the food that we eat. The footprint of Ben & Jerry's is large. There are a not insignificant number of Rabbanim and Chabad houses that we all want to utilize for business trips, that we all want to utilize as a place to eat, that we all hope are there to send their next generation become B'nai Torah, who made decisions based on a Ben & Jerry's L'mashal that was kosher, hashkafically, that was not involved in BDS a month ago, a year ago, 2 years ago. And be aware that you're affecting those people. Is that enough to say we shouldn't pull? I don't think that argument alone is enough. Is it enough to say that we have to financially back them? Yes. I remember once at a kashrus conference, someone, Shkocha, made a fantastic point. He said that we want mashgichim on the one hand to tell us adavad when they see something wrong, but we have to recognize they're throwing themselves out of business, right? If you call up, if you certify Lamare, I don't know why I chose them, because they would never serve trace, and you saw them serving trace, and you call up the OU and they're serving trace. So they're going to close the array and you're going to lose your job. So he said, we have to create an insurance company or an insurance industry where these mashgichim have parnosa. And I remember sitting there thinking it's such a responsible way of looking at things. So I'm not saying that alone is reason not to certify Ben & Jerry's. But we can't put our head in the sand. And it's so easy. You know, we as Rabbanim know this when people challenge decisions we make and they don't have all the information, nor could we share all the information. This is one piece of the puzzle that at the very least has to be dispassionately discussed. And I truly believe that if ever a Vad pulls based on hashkafic matters that were non-existent when this rabbi made his decision to stay in Oklahoma or wherever it may be, that he has to be supported by the klal. Either we are klal, but not just when we want to be a club.
Okay, I hear that, and I think we're in agreement that we need to always have heightened sensitivity to all those who are affected by our decisions. At the same time, there are certain times that it does make sense to take a moral stand on something. I just want to add one last point that you made in the article that I want to raise. You wrote fascinatingly that Rav Nata Greenblatt Shlita pointed out about a particular sefer that really was an absolute out-and-out attack on Rav Moshe itself. And Rav Nata asked Rav Moshe, you know, if he's going to make a machala. And Rav Moshe said, when I bang on the bima and protest that sefer, then everyone's going to go out and buy the sefer. Yeah, I'll just add to you, I'll mention to you, I once heard that when they published the eighth volume of Igros Moshe, Rav Shaptai Rappaport brought a copy to Rav Yashiv, and Rav Yashiv said, you know, they asked me to put this in Cherem. So Rabbi Rappaport said, I wish you would have. It would increase sales. You know, that sometimes, you know, bringing...
That was Chelechet?
Giving it... What's that?
That was Chelechet?
Yeah, Chelechet.
That's a great story.
So, the point that you were trying to make was that sometimes when you fight against something, people will want to defend the victim. I would just argue, again, just to push back, that it's hard to imagine that the Jewish community will want to defend Ben & Jerry's, meaning we all agree what they've done is morally reprehensible. I don't think pulling a hashkacha from them, not that I'm arguing that you should pull a hashkacha from them, but I don't think it's the same as, you know, standing up for you know, making a machal in your own kavod or standing up for something that might turn the other party into the victim. It's very hard within the Frum community, at least, to turn people who support BDS into a victim, where that people will want to defend.
Rabbi Leibowitz, your reputation precedes you because you saved your, I mean, all your points were strong, but your strongest for last. Let me start with that. You know, obviously, I was given a judgment from that newspaper that the article can't be more than 1,400 words. If you count them, they're exactly 1,399. Meaning I had a lot more to say. So on this last argument, it was actually titled Food Fight. And what I wanted to say, and I'll say it now, and when I say Eschatayi Masker Hayoyim, well, you'll realize in a minute what I mean. What I was trying to say there is as follows. Not that we shouldn't stand up on principle or even pull hashkacha or I mean, as I pointed out in the article, we should certainly stop buying it and our dollars and our voices make noise. When I say it's Chatzeri Maaskeri Yayim, I follow the news quite closely. And I try to read from people across the spectrum, left, right, and center. And I noticed after Ben and Jerry's, in a non-Jewish world, completely removed from Israel and Judaism, people who are not anti-Semitic, people who are just burdens, beasts of burdens of the political world. And their direction they were moving in is, why are there laws in Oklahoma, state I just mentioned, which is true, you cannot get hired as a teacher in a public school in Oklahoma unless you sign a declaration against BDS. Now, I'm very happy that exists. I don't want to bring attention to it. I know that Governor DeSantis now gave like a ultimatum to Ben and Jerry's to either sign a declaration against BDS, something to that effect, or they have to leave the state. The very smart and influential Gentiles who speak to a broad spectrum of the intelligentsia of this country, if we are too loud, it could harm us in the end. To bring attention to our Kashrus framework, you have to remember when that Kashrus organization was deciding if they should keep Ben and Jerry's on the Hashgacha, this was on Fox News, this was on CNN, ABC, everybody covered this. I got very frightened. As I pointed out in the article, it was one of the heads of the Star K who said this, we live in a miracle. The fact that we can walk into a Piggly Wiggly in the middle of North Carolina and 65% of the product sold on shelves is kosher makes zero sense. Don't toy with that. So the idea of the story of Mutter Greenblatt, Volker Zunstein, was be very careful what you draw attention to. A, BDS is something that we have tremendous support in the non-Jewish world. Don't push it too far. It was upsetting that now more people know how I think 35 out of 50 states have anti-BDS laws. I want those anti-BDS laws. Some things have to be still a hate. And number two, when it comes to kashrus, you know how many times, this may surprise the listener, that a company director would make comments to me about the kosher tax? They know that we're a small minority. They're not fools. So you try to throw in seven-day Adventists. What percentage are they, Rabbi? Oh, but also Muslims. Muslims now have their own halal certification. They're getting in on it. Kashrus is a dream. We are so fortunate. It's such a mazel. And I want to assure the reader, the listener, excuse me, of at least my opinion. I don't believe it's guaranteed. You go to Europe, which I've been for kashrus and other reasons, things don't have hashgachas. You have to get come with a list. It's very complicated. And even that's amazing. Come to America, we're in Golos. It's not guaranteed that it's going to stay. So the Maisa with Ramesha is just bringing too much attention to the framework of kashrus. You have to remember also, in the 70s already, there was a case in New York Supreme Court against Shechita. The progressive world is ready and willing to leap on kashrus. And what happens, Rabbi Leibowitz, when the progressive world discovers that the OU on their Coca-Cola represents an organization that will never allow a rabbi to run a gay wedding? What happens then when this is reversed? So I called a food fight, even though I couldn't finish all of this. This works both ways. You open up this box, you will not have kosher supermarkets other than Klein's, and which are a wonderful company, and Lieber's and Pashka's, which is fine. They're wonderful organizations. We're going to lose everything. What's the name of the company? Chick-fil-A. Chick-fil-A. One of the most successful, I believe, every Chick-fil-A franchise makes about $9 million a year. Chick-fil-A almost lost everything during the fight over gay marriage because they once gave a donation. This is a Pandora's box we do not want opened. Sometimes, from the mice of our Misha, being still a hate is the best advice.
Right, I hear that. Let's maybe just conclude this by, I'll make the very quick point that I think we all agree that that what Ben and Jerry did is reprehensible, that the BDS movement, if it's not Shvichus Damim, it's not Bezrael of Shvichus Damim. So we are dealing with something that is very, very serious. And then I think, the argument to maintain kosher supervision, whether it be the kashrus agency themselves saying that this is the best chance to get them to reverse that decision, or whether it be the broader points that you're making, in no way should ever be construed as us not taking seriously what is an extremely, extremely dangerous thing that that this company has done.
Not only do I agree 100% dangerous, and that is opening up their own Pandora's box, but the more Haredi listener needs to know that the BDS movement has the potential to affect every yeshiva and every kollel in Eretz Yisrael. This is something that is as you said, it's not shvichat damim as a zayde or shvichat damim, but more than that, the biblical Torah could cause we're so fortunate that we have a country that is at the forefront. I think it's the number three country on the NASDAQ, and that supports a tremendous amount of Torah. And this could have just a disastrous effect. We have to fight BDS as best we can, but we have to, as leaders, have to use pichus. And all these arguments, I'm not trying to convince anybody, but they have to be said out loud and considered.
Right. Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate all of the time that you gave me and the fascinating insight. It's always such a pleasure to talk to you.
I could speak to you for 6 hours, not just one. Have a continued hatzlach on everything that you do, and your Kesher Shem Tov should continue to thrive.
Thank you very much. Take care.